Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Duff Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most familiar work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And of course, since this is a Reflections episode, we have some very special guests. Welcome, Malia and Jenny from Pale in Comparison. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Yes, we're very excited to have our what do you call it? Competitors. Yeah. Competing packed podcast here, trying to siphon away all our awesome downloads.
Yeah, I don't think we're quite there yet, but that's nice. So what you'd say.
If you all aren't listening to Pale in Comparison, you've got it's quickly become one of my favorite podcasts to listen to each week.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
If not only just for the absolutely hilarious each week episode titles, which I really regret, we just do very boring episode titles where our episodes are just titled after the chapters that we're talking about. And I really admire how much effort goes into making these brilliant and terrible episode titles each and every week.
Yeah, we actually, Jenny loves puns and was coming up with a bunch of different packed and pale related puns. And so we have a short list of those in case for some reason we can't figure one out for an episode, but we haven't had to use them yet. So that's nice.
That's true.
we'll have to give this episode a name.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to think about a. But Elliot, that would break the format that we've done, and that would drive me crazy. Oh my God, that's
true. I was going to say.
Put it in the description?
True.
Yeah, true. I mean, okay. Yeah.
How we usually do it is just wait for me to say something dumb, and then that usually makes it into the title. So, if in doubt, I'm sure that whatever we decide will work.
We'll just keep your ear out for any potential good titles, and we can just put a list of possible ones in the in the description for the episode.
All right.
But anyway, we're here to reflect on one after another, Arc 10. It was Arc 10, right? Just ended? Yeah,
yes.
Arc 10. Cool. So just in case you aren't familiar with what happened in Arc 10, because again, it was a long one with a lot of different perspectives, we're going to quickly run through each of the chapters. So first of all, we started in Arc 10, we started in 10.1, we were cutting back and forth between Avery and Snowdrop, tying the knot, as it were, doing their familiar ritual, and then jumping out onto the Dance Dance Revolution Path Promenade, where the wolf showed up at the very end. Man, again, every time we do one of these episodes, I think, oh yeah, that was in this arc.
I know, right?
The familiar ritual, that was so long ago.
So long.
And then next we jumped into 10.A, our first interlude from John's perspective as he was developing an identity back in the war. And then he was thrust into a leadership position he didn't want after a confrontation with that practitioner guy whose name I've forgotten. then we cut ahead to him taking on the wolf in the present. The wolf takes the form of Yolda, because of course it does. And he makes it out alive in the end, but not a happy man.
No. Then next we go to Far Cry 14.12. Then we fast forward to the future as we see the last remaining survivors scraping by and attempting to stop the culprits, Cherry Pop and Murby, from taking their throne as Carmine Poppers.
That's a horrifying sentence, by the way. I'm not sure who wrote that, but it's terrible.
Not it. Not me.
Was this you, Elliot?
I think so, yeah. But you're a monster. I mean, this was our only extra material for the arc as well. I just want to call that out. Like, what a hilarious thrill ride of an extra material it was.
Yeah.
So then in 10.B, from Sig's perspective, this is not my fault. Okay. Sig watches out as innocents cry. Melissa pouts and other fries. A witch hunter has come to town.
That was amazing.
Well that was done. Great. Thank you.
In 10C, we get a peek into Chloe's depressing existence as she battles her disability and tries to find the light in a life that is very literally devoid of any kind of light and warmth. She turns down an offer from Rook before she and Nibble go for a stroll. And of course, things continue to get worse. They run into the witch hunter. They manage to escape for now and find the Kenneteers.
Yep, and then we jump into Lucy's perspective for 10.2 as she, Avery, John, and the ghouls. Oh, and I suppose Melissa too. I forgot to include her in my list. They're all running away.
Who needs her?
Sorry, I was just listing the helpful people. We see some flashbacks where Lucy says goodbye to Booker. She finally sort of approves of Alyssa. We find out, Melissa is super drunk. And we learn about that syringe that Melissa found in Edith's cabin.
All right, then we go to 10.D, and of course D stands for demon, as we know from our podcast. Let me see. Albie sees him when he's sleeping. Thank God he's not awake. He thinks all others are bad, not good, and he never takes a break. There you go.
I've enjoyed these so much. Mm-hmm. The Christmas spirit is alive.
Yeah. It's completely not connected to Christmas in any way. But whatever.
We're going to find it.
I mean, I think, the witch hunter just has some Christmas spirit that's rubbing off on us. All right.
Yes. And then in 10.E, it's the 100th chapter. We get Toadswallow's perspective. We see his origins as a little trickster, then as sort of a caring babysitter, as a fairy troll, and ultimately teacher extraordinaire. Then we cut to the present as he makes Snowdrop a job offer and lets slip his not-so-evil plan.
That plan, of course, overheard by Lucy, and in 10.3 we're back in Lucy's perspective. She doesn't really comment on how great that plan is, but I'm sure we'll get to that later. She heads off with Guillemet to fight the witch hunter. Guillemet teaches Lucy to fish rather than just giving her a fish. Edith argues against helping and then follows through by just lighting a lot of things on fire, including Guillemet. Mariska comes in for the kill steal, and Lucy realizes that the real enemy is the friends that we made along the way.
And then in 10.4, Verona makes her triumphant return as she interviews the Child Protective Services people. She hangs out with Tash on the beach and finally manages to bond with her mom for a bit. Then on the way home, she sort of checks in with various others and local lords as she heads back to Kennet and runs into an old friend, which is Miss. Rook shows up too. Mostly it's the fact that she hung out with Tash on the beach.
That's really the important part of that chapter. But then next, 10.Z. Finally, we see the origins of the girl by candlelight as her various echoes and spirits gather, and she starts to become a person. She meets Matthew, falls for him, and accepts the body of Edith James in order to stay alive. But in order to be with him, she accepts a bit of help from Mariska.
Which is always a good idea, isn't it?
Yeah. Something you should never do is accept help from Mariska. Interestingly, our protagonists have done that a few times. So
They didn't know better. They didn't really know better, even though everyone told them.
They did know better.
Okay, I guess you're right. Yeah,
this was by far my favorite arc, so I'm excited we get to be on this episode.
Yeah, this is an amazing arc. So
it was a big arc, wasn't it? A lot of stuff, a lot of progressions. It really feels like we're getting towards the end game of stuff.
Mm.
Well, it was really the setup of the end game, because it was this was the one that sort of really taught us kind of where so many people in town are standing as we head into things. It was the upper sort of okay, let's just sort of confirm for you where a bunch of people are standing, the ghouls, Sig, John.
Yeah, which is, very useful to be able to see into, especially a lot of the newer others, because, some of it is just getting to see into Sig's perspective as well, that was really interesting. I know that's kind of a ways up, but I didn't realize he had such a personality, to be honest, but it was really neat.
I think it really helped establish the new Kennet others as more settled characters. I mean, with the exception of some of the goblins, they were kind of you don't know any of the goblins who died, which was interesting. But I mean, Sig and Liss, and I mean, obviously Tashlet and Monty, but that was more or less arc, but they just feel like such a part of Kennet. And it's weird remembering that they weren't there at the beginning.
Yeah, true. That's true.
Yep. I'm just always a fan of these like interlude heavy arcs as well. Like arc five mm-hmm. was another one with all the aware. And obviously in some of the other like Wabo stories, they're always a hit, and they always feel so massive because each chapter gives you so much being from a new perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I like everything in the story, man. Everything's good. Like, just keep it going. Yeah, you don't have to end. Just keep writing just until they're like 50 years old.
Until 14.12.
Yeah, the actual 14.12. Yes.
That would be the wildest thing ever if like the story not only makes it that far, but 14.12 ends up being like exactly where it goes. Like,
oh man.
Yeah. Wabo just reposts that entire chapter without the "it was all a dream" bit at the end.
Yeah, is that like confirmation that Avery and Snowdrop make it through the story?
Well, they make it through the story up until 14.12.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
So, speaking of Avery and Snowdrop, this is something that happened in this arc, their familiar ritual. Shall we dive into that a bit?
Yeah, that felt so huge at the start, mm-hmm. but it's like, this is a testament to how big this arc is. It was like, I almost forgot. Like, it's just the first chapter of this arc. Like, that's such a big deal. And I almost lost it in this epic arc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally forgot that the promenade was, like you're saying, at the beginning of this arc, because it spans such a long, period of time writing. I don't know, but it was, I really, really loved their familiar ritual. Just that they kind of just said, screw you, like, fuck off to all you toxic traditions. And just like, they made it their own, which is great. It still is just as important as like doing all the, I guess, fancy circles and diagrams and things. But mm-hmm. I loved it. And I just kept thinking, like, it was really neat to be able to see all the other Lost present there, just along with everybody else they invited. But how, like, I guess, groundbreaking and refreshing it must have been for all those Lost to see, like, like, this practitioner's not a straight up asshole. Like, they actually seem like they care about, they're familiar. It was really cool to see. I'm glad they were able to do that.
It's a Wild Bow story, so I keep waiting for like the bad things to happen. And when they were setting it up, I was really worried because they like weren't going to do a diagram. And I was like, will that mess this up? Like, the practice has kind of so much of it is like drawing diagrams and doing different things. And I was kind of like, oh no, is this going to really like mess everything up? But like, of course it didn't, because it's Avery and Snowdrop. And like, the Kenneteers have learned about how flexible the practice can be and like how to break boundaries. And it was just like, it's fun. I feel like, especially this arc, they've been ramping up their like the ethical way of doing the practice. And also like later Verona with the recycling and everything, it just feels like they're really, really, really trying to be good people. And it's really lovely.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Not to mention just like, breaking traditions and things and like, doing their familiar ritual on a freaking path. Like, come on, guys. Like, talk about taking the hard road. Like, I know it fits, but what, like, about like 10 gazillion things could have gone wrong just with that alone, not to mention not doing a diagram and all that. They're like, she's got some cojones. Like, yeah, I don't know. She's brave to, she and Snowdrop both like were brave to be doing all of that without any example of someone who's done something similar in the past, because like Malia is saying, that totally could have gone very badly.
It was also fortunate that like this path has like a waiting area, because like you couldn't do this in like Zoom Town or whatever. That's what I was imagining, right? Like, if they were like on the dance floor of the promenade, like they couldn't just be like, all right, let's stand here for a really long time. So that worked out in their favor.
That's true. Oh man. Yeah, it warmed my heart. I really liked it.
Yeah, I'm so glad it seems to have worked really well, because I had the same worry. It was like it was happening on the paths and like without the diagram, and I was like, I think this is all cool, but like it's so far from what that book in Arc 6 sort of told us it was going to be like. And I was like, I hope this works out. And yeah, I'm glad it did.
I also wonder what Cherry Pop thought was happening, because that was delightful how she kept being like, I think Snowdrop's winning. And I was like, what do you think is going on? What if someone ever tried to make Cherry Pop a familiar? Like, could she consent? Like, it's okay, just who would really do that?
Like, yeah, luckily I don't think that will come up.
I don't think that's possible.
I'm trying to imagine that.
I guess Cherry Pop probably just lives in this constant state of having no fucking idea what's going on. So, like, she probably didn't understand it, but that's just how she is. So she just sort of goes with it.
That's just, like, her norm. She's comfortable there, you know? Like, it's okay. You don't have to know everything. You know, you don't have to be right about things or, you know, understand what's going on in the world. You can just, I mean, it's better if you do, arguably, but... <I don't know. laughs> But then like they jump straight into that path right afterwards, which that was a pretty crazy, pretty interesting and intricate path. Like, even just looking at all the other paths we've seen, I guess excluding Mrs. Interlude, I guess we kind of know what's going on and are assuming that they've been fleshed out. Whereas this one, not only doing the familiar ritual, but also getting to be part of, discovering like the rules and how everything plays, along in that path. That was, pretty interesting to see as well.
Yeah. Like play testing or something. I liked how they had all the walkie talkies and they had all their little like gadgets and gizmos, but it didn't feel very magical. Like it was like, of course, like humans are coming into this space and like not understanding it. And then just like kind of disrupting everything. It was just this weird mix of like watching people try to figure out a system that they're not supposed to be a part of. I don't know.
Yeah, I really liked that vibe of how it was the home. It felt like the home or the territory of the lost, and the humans definitely felt like they were intruding.
True. That's very true. And I mean, it's good the Garricks were there to kind of organize stuff. Man, are they just the most annoying people in the world, right? Like, how did Jude get to be, like, so chill and cool? Just, like, everybody else got the annoying genes, and he got, like, the nice, cool genes. And everyone else just kind of sucks a little bit.
He's definitely the Avery of his family.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
That's true. Yeah, that makes so much sense. I never connected that, but
that's why they're so perfect together.
Yeah, that blows my mind. That's probably obvious to everyone else, but that did not click with me.
Yeah, I was worried that. I mean, I like how Jude's been written this whole time, because I don't remember him ever being like mansplainy or anything about like Zoomtown. And he obviously was like interested in Avery, but has like completely dropped it. And now it's just this, but he's also like, you know, not like, oh, like she's a lesbian, stop. Like he doesn't out her. They have this like kind of thing to bond over, but he's also not like still like, ooh, I can make her like me or whatever. I love Jude. His like aviator hat. It's so good.
And he's specifically putting up with shit from his family around this while not, you know, he could theoretically end it, or at least change it, I guess, maybe.
True.
by outing Avery. He's just not going to, because he's a chill guy.
He's a nice good guy. On him. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think like on top of that as well, like as Avery continues to do well, like I think she hopefully impressed the majority of the family this way. And so it's going to kind of be like Avery and Jude have actually kind of flipped it, and now they're fucking with the family, because they're going to be like, the family's going to be doing all this stuff because they're like, oh, Jude's in with Avery, like this is really great, and Jude and Avery are just going to play them. This
that's
crap.
So great.
I'm totally ready for that.
Oh yeah, I'm so for that. Just be like, oh yeah, we'll just slowly start giving her the family secrets until she's ready to, you know, get a ring on her finger, and like, yeah.
Nope.
Good luck with that.
But yeah, no, yeah. I agree. Jude got a lot of respect for me from how like he just sort of instantly once Avery basically told him she wasn't interested, he just switched to like friend mode. And that was like, really good to see. Like, I like
definitely. It. Yeah, he's really cool. Yeah. If she did get outed, I probably would almost expect her family just to like grab one of the girls in the family and be like, "Here, like, here's Avery." Like, you like girls, right? They seem pretty like hardcore about that. So,
Man. It must be just a lot more convenient to marry your child off to a practitioner than to worry about like having to introduce someone else to the practice. Plus, Avery's just like super badass. So, I mean, one of those cousins has got to be gay, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, who wouldn't want her in the family? She's amazing. Man. But I love seeing all the little details to these, the paths, like jumping on the table and getting those, like getting the rules and getting a free snack. That's not really the most important part, but I love all those little details like that. And I really, kind of jumping ahead a little teeny bit. It was kind of satisfying in a way, just to see like how terrified everyone else was of the wolf, just because, seeing it from just Avery's perspective, you kind of have in your head, like, well, obviously the wolf was scary, but it's a 13-year-old girl. Not to say that her perspective's not valid or anything, but to see all these other seasoned practitioners freaking out and trying to pack up and like just get out of there. It's like, puts it into even more perspective. Like, man, she was there for 13 hours with this thing. Mm-hmm. And she's somehow functional, you know. It's insane, like how brave and amazingly strong she is. I was nowhere, I'm sure. Well, yeah, when I was 13, like,
and
yeah, I'd be crying.
it's especially worth pointing out that her wolf was like worse than everyone else's, right? Like,
that's true.
It's confirmed by Jude. She spent more time with her wolf than anybody else here, and her wolf was like more evil than anyone else's. Like,
yeah, that's oof. True.
Man. They do a really good job of building that up because they have this like experienced finder who knows a lot of other finders talking to Avery about the like Forest Ribbon Trail, and she's like, oh yeah, it was really hard because like these 8 things were hidden from me, and he was like, what are you talking about? And then it was like, oh yeah, and I spent 13 hours, and I'm going back and trying to reread Pale to try to keep a lot of the details about the practice in my mind, and they make a very big deal to Avery in the instructions about like, make sure that you forget, like make sure you make a deal to forget your experience with the wolf, because it's going to be like really horrific. And then she doesn't. She's like, no, I want to remember this. She's like, she's so great and strong and wonderful.
Yeah. She doesn't see it, which is insane. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you not see how cool you are? Like, you're like the coolest, man. Yeah, and after all that, when the wolf is chasing her all around the board and everything, she taunts the wolf, like, oh, you didn't get me. Does that bug you? Like, man, I don't even, like, it's like everyone else is basically peeing their pants trying to get away, and she's like, oh, yeah, you didn't get me. Like, what? You're insane. Like, yeah, I don't know. You're nuts. In a good way.
Yeah. Did y'all have more thoughts about the stuff before we talk about John? We kind of arranged it by characters.
Yeah.
Which just turned into our chapters, basically.
Makes sense. I'm just like, we have to be going back to the prom, right? Like, it didn't feel like we were done there.
We got to figure out what rule it is that called the wolf over as well. Because, what kind of crappy. Yeah. What are the other rules?
What other rules can you get from jumping up on the table? Yeah,
it's interesting.
That's true.
My assumption was we were going to go back as a way to bring Miss back into the story, but obviously that's already happened elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of thinking, like, what reasons would they have to go back to the promenade now that there's probably bigger things to deal with? And I don't have any good answers.
Well, the wolf, because the wolf is the other big pathy thing. We have, like, I didn't feel like we were done with the wolf, and now the wolf's all up in John's head. Like, maybe that. maybe that'll come into it somehow. It's like, as you know, the stuff gets going with John, potentially taking the Carmine throne or whatever. Maybe that, like, the wolf gets involved in that somehow. If she's in his head the same way she's in Avery's.
Oh, that's terrifying. Ugh. Yeah, I do really want to see the promenade again. That's such a cool path. I think that's my favorite path so far, because it's just, well, maybe part of it's the mystery, but I also want to see where the trains go. I mean, I'm pretty sure they probably go to a different path and drop you off, but if you have to get on a train and go somewhere, I'd love to see that. But
and that red bridge thing was very intriguing, or whatever, like the one that they almost went to but didn't, because if you put too many red papers in the door or whatever, like, just there are so many things that, like, have been left as possible little Easter eggs. I kind of don't think we're going back, to be honest. It just feels like, I mean, maybe as like a quick thing as we're like dealing with the Carmine killers or whatever. But all the things like with like Avery and Jude and like how their dynamic's gonna go, and like,
yeah,
I just need sequels. Like, I hate that the story ends at the end of the summer, because so many things can't happen. Or, like, yeah, I can't see them.
True. I was thinking about the other day. I could see Pale going a bit beyond the summer. I don't know.
Elliot, don't say it or you'll make it true. We'll be doing this podcast forever.
Like, just because I guess Pale doesn't always just, like, fit itself into the box of, like, the police procedural or something. So, yeah, like, things might not... Like, the Carmine throne thing might kind of wrap up by the end of the summer or anything, but that won't necessarily be the very end of the story. I don't know. Like, there might be a bit more to the conflict than just whoever takes the throne.
I'm starting to get the impression that the Otherverse must just be and I can kind of feel it through the writing, must just be the funnest setting to write stories in. Because it's designed to be like an author's playground, right? So I really think, even if it's not Pale, even if it's not the Kentiers, I'm sure we're just going to get more opportunities to play with amazing stories that we will be delighted by here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
Hopefully there'll be like an epilogue where Avery goes back to the paths at the very least. Especially because I want to see Avery go to the promenade as like, my favorite part of the promenade was when she was just like walking up to like the ballerina and being like, oh, hey, how's it going? Like, I want like experienced path Avery to just like go to the promenade and just like chat to her mates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was great.
Of all the characters you want to see featured in an epilogue, Elliot, the promenade is at the top of the list.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty great. I mean, who knows? Maybe even if we don't get it in the story, maybe we'll get a short story with the promenade or a word of God or something about it later on. But yeah, I'm like, this can't be the end of it forever. We need to hear some more stuff. It's too good. At least I like it. let me see. I guess next, if nobody has anything else on that section, like, because I know it went to John next. Because he was obviously the next one to help out.
We have a fun ethical dilemma that we don't fully agree on.
We don't. And it kind of John's stems existence. From... Okay, and this kind of stems from one of your previous podcasts about saying if John ethically... Like, if Dogs of War are ethically, like, okay to exist, right? I'm not making that up, right? You guys did say something about that.
Yeah. Okay. Honestly, I think we could probably expand that to all others in general, but we can start with Dogs of War and have this conversation.
It's very easy to have the argument about Dogs of War because, like, for me, it's sort of like I can't abide supporting having Dogs of War because they have to kill people to turn into someone cool like John. But then on the other hand, I don't know that I could necessarily be a part of a movement to, like, eradicate them and like commit genocide on them. So it's very both outcomes feel kind of unacceptable to me.
Yeah, they're both kind of they're both icky. That's not a great word, but yeah, they both don't feel right. We're kind of torn, but I mean, I probably would be leaning more on the side it's more ethical for them to be wiped out for the same kind of things that you're saying in terms of, like, yes, you can. And I'm not saying I want this to happen to John. I freaking love John. He's amazing. But you know, to make one dog of war that is possibly a good guy, like, how many people did he have to kill to get not just each one of his physical features? He had to kill one person for his first name, one person for his last name. And then he, like, every, it's, it seems like every quality he has to kill somebody for. Or is those people all could, it's like a really, this probably doesn't totally apply, but it almost is like a really fucked up trolley problem. Where it's like, you could, you know, keep, kill like 50 people, or like, and have this one really awesome person. That doesn't really track, but I don't know.
It's... The thing that makes it stand out to me as well is it seems like to get a nice dog of war, you have to kill a nice person, right? Like,
yes.
That is the most damning thing to me. Any good positive traits that John has are ones that are because he killed people with those positive traits, which is kind of fucked up.
It is. And what if he killed, like, some real psychos? Then he would be, like, a complete, like... I mean, he, not only does he have, like, the supernatural ability to, like, carry out and kill all these people, but now he has more of a will to do some crazy... crazy ass things because he killed some crazy people, you know.
I just feel like I don't know what to, I mean, for all I know this isn't real and I don't have to deal with it, but I don't know what to do. Like, I think that the best scenario is like war doesn't exist anymore, so like dogs aren't made. That feels better than like just destroying them. I mean, I think it was, I was in a situation as a practitioner or whatever, and there's like a dog of war and like it's just gonna try to kill me, like I would fight it, obviously. But like, I don't know, like, where do you draw the line? Because there's like, like, there's like spirits and leaves and stuff, like what Elliot said, like all others, I think it was Elliot and not Ruben, one of you said this like 10 minutes ago. But like, I mean, others are what humans have kind of put out into the world, from what I understand. Like, they're like concepts that like we live with and develop and generate, but also there's just like leaves and like other, like everything has spirits, I guess. But like the abyssal beast, right? Like, you need it to stop hurting the people who are around you, but does that mean it like doesn't have a right to exist and we should just like kill it? Like, that just makes me sad. Like, maybe send it back to the abyss. I don't know where you send dogs. Like, binding dogs is also really sad. But also just being like, let's stop war so that dog, I mean, we can stop war for other reasons, but if we're doing it just so we're like, let's prevent dogs from being created at all, that also feels kind of gross. I don't know, like, and then like with like echoes, like, should everyone go around and like hug echoes? Like, should echoes just be like comforted and then like disappear? Like, maybe, but also that's like ending them and their existence, but maybe like their existence isn't maybe good existence for them, sucks. But it's all that they have. I don't know. Ugh,
it's hard. Thank goodness we don't have to worry about this in real life, but it is hard. It is hard.
Well, I suppose to like touch on like sort of the metaphor, like if a lot of these others, because so many of the others we've seen in Pale are, do seem to come about like, yeah, from humans and human thoughts and emotions. It's kind of like, if you look at the echoes, like they're like sort of bad, well, mostly they seem to be bad thoughts made manifest. And it's like, I guess just like getting rid of them all, like, you know, things like guilt or anxiety exist for a reason. Like, it's just as unhealthy to be completely without them. So, yeah, I don't know. Like,
yeah,
even with something like the dog of war, like, Do we want absolutely no violence? I mean, I feel like we do, but maybe, so that's probably not a good example, but yeah.
I was like, I don't know. If only, like, if dogs of war could go around to, like, soldiers and people who are, like, about to die and, like in their misery. I mean, I know that's not what they're, you know, wired to do, but that would be, like, more ethical, that'd be okay. Be like, all right, go ahead and, you know, end the misery because they're gonna die anyway.
it's like Musette, that ghoul,
yeah,
who, like, you know, she had to eat children, but she found like the way to do it that I had absolutely no ethical qualms with.
That's the way to do it. She made their life better, and then, you know, if they didn't, well, only if they said it was okay. if they said it wasn't okay, then she wouldn't do it. But I mean, I feel like, yeah, for some, if you're made to do that, like that's the way to do it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, seeing John's backstory was really heartbreaking. And then, it was horrific. Honestly, like to see like all these basically young men that they had to kill, in order to get more of a self. And then it just is interesting because it turned from that just from being completely switched to that practitioner being like incredibly horrifying and, you know, binding all of his or most of his friends and killing that journalist out of nowhere. And it was just, man, John, like no one, he really just needs to become an actual dog and just like hang out, you know. He deserves some peace and quiet in his life. Like,
yeah, that was so heartbreaking, learning how much he actually would have liked to be Lucy's familiar.
That hurt so freaking bad. Like, I want you to go in the sun and do nothing, you know. as painful. He's just like, he can't get too close, but it's like, can't you get a little bit close though? Like you can, like you can get a little close. I don't know. Don't listen to the wolf. Like they're gonna. He's like, don't listen to the wolf. Like that's the last person thing you should take advice from. You know. I mean, maybe he's got a point, but like, get that point from other people, not the wolf. Okay. And then of course the wolf is Yalda. Like at. His breeze, and he has to face Yalda tearing into his like abdomen and his chest. Like, of course, he hasn't been through enough crap. That's fine.
I still want to see the conversation that led to them deciding that was the way to go. You know, when like Lucy and Verona and all the others are sort of putting this together, they're like, yeah, Breeze won, Yalda the looking unstoppable, hungry choir thing we barely managed to kill. That's a good
reasonable. Yeah, what the hell? I'd like to even see if Bree was for that or not. I would like to think that she was like, this is a terrible idea. But yeah, what a weird choice to make. But I'm guessing the Garrick's just like, we're all crappy and ganged up and we're like, no, she's a little girl. She can't do crap. I don't know. Because I just feel like everybody else, like, that knows Avery, and I don't know. I feel like everybody else should know better about Yalda.
Yeah, but, exactly.
Yeah.
I still feel confused about Yalda. Like, how did she kill people? Because I don't... It's like, was she a sick dog? And, like, spread a plague? Or, like, did she just go around randomly killing people? Like, it didn't make sense. I don't know if y'all know what's going on, but like, to me, Yalda's not, I mean, the Hungry Choir is very scary, but like Yalda as Yalda doesn't strike me as very scary, but I know that that's the reason she had to die was because she was like killing people or something.
Like, I don't think it ever went into detail about how she does it, but I know like, it was supposed to be through what, curses and through, I guess
like making people sick.
Yeah.
Like, was kind of the vibe I got.
And she just can't help herself?
Well, just like, I mean, just like the dogs of war killing people, you know, like it's part of, you know, part of the nature and part of like increasing their self, I guess.
I just want to say, like, I think like John doesn't necessarily seek out violence, but he always seems to end up amongst it. So maybe like with Yalda, just like even if it's something she's not really aiming to do, she just ends up in situations where her being around leads to people getting sick or something.
True. And some illnesses can take people pretty quick, you know? So
yeah,
it's like, depending on what it is, it's, you know, could happen. but I also just want to step back a little bit and John, for one, like being at this ritual and feeling really kind of isolated, like he can't go talk to anybody, either on his side or anywhere else. And then after that, just still being like, okay, I need to jump in immediately to help save Avery. Like, it's so sweet and just so like, man, I can't even articulate it, but it just makes your heart hurt, you know? like, you're such a good dude. And also, what a, like, the fact that John faces the wolf and, like, has to freaking run because it's so terrifying. Like, Avery, what the heck, man? You're so, like, badass. I don't understand. I don't get it. I mean, it's good, but like, how did you become so badass? Like, John ran away. And, anyway. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I guess we'll see where he goes in arc 11. Cause that whole thing at the end with him and the Sable Prince is very like,
What the hell does that mean?
Yeah. What is it even? Yeah.
What is that? Like, yeah, I don't understand.
Because the Sable Prince's job is like death or something, or right?
Non-living?
Or what were the other two?
Yeah, I think the Aurum is like civilization, or that was like the gold centipede guy. Mm-hmm. And then the Alabaster was like innocence, and Alabaster's a white color, I think.
Okay.
And then I think the Sable Prince was like death sort of stuff. Mm. Although, like, death in tarot sense is more about change than, like, the end. So I don't know if it, like, leans more on transitional imagery or, like, you know, the end sort of imagery.
I guess we'll find out. But, yeah, I was just like, what the hell is happening? Like, but who knows? You know, that's why we have to make some bold and specific predictions later that are definitely going to be incorrect, but someone's got to do it.
So next up was Sig.
Yes.
Or Melissa, actually. We got tricked into thinking this was a Melissa interlude at first.
That's true. Yeah, that totally tripped me up. Especially just like her looking over at her social media and being like, oh, like, these stupid dancers think that they're going to do well. I'm like looking at all that stuff. And I was like, oh, like a Melissa interlude. And then, yeah, that totally tripped me off. and it's just, yeah, for not being able to say anything, I guess, besides burning paper or anything. Yeah, he's got a lot more, I guess, thought or like free will than I would have expected. He pretty much goes wherever he wants. And
as long as there's like smokers nearby.
Yeah.
I think that's like the constraint. But yeah, he's funny. He's like kind of an asshole. It's really funny.
Kind of an asshole.
It's like, I'm going to be on your windowsill.
Your mom's going to get mad at you.
Every time she turned around and just lost her shit, I was giggling. It's so good.
It's so funny. So, man, I was like, wow, you're a total dick. But, you know, maybe she'd get a little bit of a taste of her own medicine, okay?
Like, but yeah, and just the way that it wasn't, like, the narration wasn't completely focused on Sig because Sig doesn't have, like, I guess, conscious thought or something. Like made it even funnier because you had to wait for Melissa to turn around and notice him. And it was just like, oh, it was so good every time.
It was so good. And it was neat getting to see all the different types of places that he gets to jump to. The group of, grieving people. And yeah, he just jumped all over the place, which was fantastic. Probably more places than I can go because I'm asthmatic. So Sig would be a better spy than me.
Only if you want to spy on smoking people.
On
smokers, yeah. That's true. I'm curious what both of your reads on that part are, right? Because he just goes and hangs out with this support group, I guess you would call it. And he never explains why he goes there, so we can only kind of theorize. But I definitely thought he was trying to just, like, be a part of a group of people that he liked, you know?
That is...
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because that might have been the only place where... This is sort of dumb, but where there were other, like, cigarettes around. I don't think he's like, oh yes, the cigarettes, my people. But I think he might be like, I mean, I'm curious as to like when and how he became sentient or like manifested or whatever, because presumably he has spent a lot of time, like smoking seems to be for a lot of people really social. And maybe he just really, yeah, likes the like chill environment of a lot of people like sitting around and kind of talking. Story-wise, it felt like an interesting, like we wouldn't get those conversations without someone like Sig, of just like some normal innocent people. And I'm not entirely sure why we did, but it was nice. It was a good rhythm or something to the story.
Yeah, I'm trying. I read this, but oh, I'm sorry. I was trying to say I reread this a few days ago. I mean, one thing that was kind of interesting as well, rereading this, that I almost feel like it may have referenced Alpi in this part, just because it was talking about, let me see, I'm trying to pull it up here. Talking about the grieving group, and one of the members was saying, I've been seeing my son in my dreams every night for almost a week. They keep getting worse, sharper in definition. So that was just kind of interesting. I was like, oh, like Alpi's doing her rounds, I guess, like trying to help. But I'm assuming trying to help in her own way.
It's not her fault. She's just doing her job.
She's doing her job. I mean, hey, not all jobs are fun jobs. So sometimes you got to do the crappy stuff to get through. But I mean, obviously he's, I don't know, maybe that's having something to do with why this guy's like reaching out for support. So maybe it's helping in that sense. I'm kind of reaching a little bit, but you know, it could be. I kind of agree with Malia. I'm not 100% sure why all this was in there, but I'm really glad it was, because it's definitely, as she was saying, not a type of conversation that you would be privy to ordinarily, unless you're in that group. But also thought it was interesting that with all that and him hanging out with the innocents and all that, why you gotta be freaking friends with Edith, man? Like, why? Like, go like find like anybody else. I mean, I get it, because she's fire and he's a cigarette, but like, can't you find like another like vaguely hot spirit or something to like hang out with that's not, I don't know, maybe that's just me, but that's my feeling to it.
No, I feel the same. You get remarkably attached to Sig, even though he doesn't talk or anything. And to see him at the end of the chapter confirm he's on the villain team, you're kind of just like, oh.
It's like a little dagger.
Yeah, exactly.
A little cigarette-shaped dagger to the heart.
Well, because he's like, it's interesting though, because like he's got that very alien consciousness. So like even though it was from his perspective, we still don't get his like internal thinking of like, this is his reason he's with Edith. Like, it might just be as simple as the fact that she's a big fire spirit and he's like, I like fire.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, because like, there's no, you know, if someone like Montague was secretly on Edith's side, I could see this internal logic for him of like, you know, being beaten down by the system and wanting to fight it with Edith or something. Whereas, like with Sig, I don't know if it's that or if he just like joined the first team that invited him because it was a fire spirit. Like,
yeah. No, I mean, I think you're probably right. And because of that, I can't really feel too mad at him, because I'm just like, well, you know, he's hanging with his, you know, with his people, I guess. But but it still is like, come on, man. Like, I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm just going
to. No, I was just going to say, I wonder how much Sig knows. I didn't get to reread the chapters as thoroughly as I would have liked before this. Exams. But he is like there when they're in bed together, which was real weird and felt very intimate and made me uncomfortable. And so maybe Sig knows like everything, especially because when he shows up, he's so innocuous. Often you can't really necessarily tell that he's there. Maybe Sig doesn't know like all of the details about stuff. And it's just sort of like, whatever. Practitioners suck.
That's extra weird, and I didn't think about that until now. And especially like, you know, in old movies and stuff, like after like a couple of like no, having sex, like, they're always smoking. So no. how does he just go? No. You let me say it.
Okay.
I'm impressed that you knew where it was going so quickly. You're very much on the same wavelength that Malia, you were just able to pick.
That's right. Like it or not, Malia. All right, well, everyone knows it. So we'll just leave it at that.
They're just like mom and dad or whatever, you know, Matthew and Edith.
I don't even mean just them. I just mean, does he just go around like hopping like to different? Oh, that's okay.
He definitely does.
Random couples.
He did just drop that by part's on fine. Matthew and Edith at specific times, so maybe that is what it was.
That's true. I don't know. He could just be going all over the place. It's wherever there's cigarettes. So who knows? I mean, we don't have to dwell on it any more than that, but we all know. Oh, jeez. Okay, I'm sorry, Malia. Jeez. Okay. It's like scarring her for life. She's like, I don't want to think about it.
So should we just jot down
Sig jokes as potential episode titles?
Oh, yeah. Good stuff.
Wildbo has like made a good up and down like highs and lows with this arc, because we go from Sig to Chloe, where like my heart is in tiny little pieces. And this was my favorite chapter of the story until 10.4 came out. But it was like a really, really deep dive into a character. It felt necessary for setting up like the later fight with Chloe, but it just really, really digs into her whole backstory and like her hopes and her dreams and her aspirations. And it was just like the very kind of mundane life of this like woman who's trying to like put her life together and like maybe never will, but has managed to hold on to enough hope that like there is an end possibly someday. And I just really love her in a way I didn't expect.
The part that's the most depressing is she thinks that there's an end in sight and she's doing so well. And then obviously this entire arc is her getting so, so much further away from that. Like, mm-hmm. We don't go back to her perspective yet, and maybe we never will, but, you know, fuck that. It's just so shattering to know that she's just been pushed further and further away from this happy ending that she's working for.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know. Her flashbacks just, like, it was devastating, like, just reading that, what happened to her. It's hard to even like how do you let that happen to somebody that like if you're in a group, like how could you just abandon someone that you cared about or you said was a friend to all these like monstrous people? I can't, like, it just makes me sick like to think about it. No wonder she turned into a ghoul, because I mean, like, I can't even speak, it's just terrible. But just rereading some of the stuff, like they're spitting in her face, and eventually they just started blaming everything on her, and Malia, you're better at talking than me sometimes, so you take this, but I hated that.
So I didn't play Far Cry 3. I think it was Far Cry 3, but it sort of reminded me of that. I don't know if are y'all familiar? I watched my friend play it.
House. That is a good point. Is that 3?
It's the one where they're like base jumping or skydiving or whatever on this like beautiful island, and they're all having fun, and then they all get like kidnapped, except for you, or maybe you break out. I don't know, but you're running around and like trying to get all your friends out that are just like captured by these people for reasons. And it just sort of reminded me of like, or like that one movie, I'm never going to see, the Swedish people in the fields or something.
Yeah, you're talking about, what's it called?
Midsummer. Yeah.
And I can't imagine being in a situation. I mean, I can't imagine being in a situation, but like, it seems like maybe your survival instincts would kick in and you'd be like, okay, like that person is probably going to die and like the rest of us need to get out of here. But it's real awful. But I just like so much rather blame the people who like kidnapped and tortured them than her friends. But I understand why she blames her friends.
Funny enough, I thought you were talking about Far Cry 5 at first, but just because
Far Cry 5.
Because that that's about a doomsday cult. So I was just thinking cultish people.
Far Cry 3 is definitely the right one that you were talking about.
No, I think you're right. But, but like, I was just like, oh yeah, but the cultishness does remind me of that a little bit. But yeah, yours may fit slightly better. Jeez. But yeah, she just tries so hard. Like she spends all this time just like scrubbing this one stall, like shower stall, and gets it gleaming and clean, and she just wants to take a shower, and then it just sets everything back. I'm so glad she has Nibble, at least. She needs a little bit of support in her life. Well, she needs a lot of support, but they're honestly a pretty wholesome match, I think. I really like them.
They felt fairly realistic to me, I think. I mean, I couldn't remember how long they'd been together, and people have pointed out like Nibble doesn't have a lot of the needs that Chloe does and maybe doesn't like understand or isn't as aware, but just the fact that he like tried to fix up the room was really sweet, because he was like, oh, she cares about this. And like, it was also like, oh, but he didn't do it perfectly. Like it wasn't like, oh, well, it's, you know, wonderful, but it was still like, oh, he tried. Like it seemed like a relationship to me that like could continue to improve if both people like continue to try. Yeah. Like it wasn't like Booker and Alyssa, who are super cute and like wandering around and getting each other coffee and whatever it is that they do. But I don't know.
Yeah, they both really care, and it's nice. It's a little sliver of wholesomeness and that hellhole.
Yeah, Chloe's ability to still be somewhat optimistic. Yeah.
And then it makes it way more horrible when like she loses it and they fight in the place that she's like trying to make a home and stuff.
Yeah, that's hard. Yeah. No, I think I agree. I think it's nice, like she really does try to be positive. And yeah, she tries really hard. And I'm so glad that she went with Nibble to go up outside, because man, she saved their butts, essentially, I think.
Yeah, she was the MVP of that for sure.
For definitely. Sure. Yeah. Like,
a thought just occurred to me, like obviously to jump ahead in the arc a little bit. So she, like obviously Chloe ends the arc in a pretty bad place.
Yeah.
But she heals from eating people, right?
No.
So like Raph's right there.
No. Is he dead? Do we know that? I'm really upset.
Oh, no.
No, he's I mean, we don't know for sure, but it's pretty unambiguous that Marisica murders him.
She definitely ate him. For sure. I'm sorry, Malia. It's okay. I didn't even think about that, but yeah, that definitely happened.
I mean, better than poisoned clockwork people, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's got to be like, that's terrible.
Waste not, want not.
Yeah, I was like, you got your like, you know, your fast food type, like, you know, in terms of quality, and then you got your little bit better, you know, like closer to filet mignon type, and then you got your frozen meals. She's pretty set now. I'm so sorry. I know.
I do hope she gets better. In that he's the one who like attacked her and like messed her up so bad, it is sort of,
that's true, it's kind of,
it's like karmically makes sense. Yeah.
I wouldn't go so far to say he deserves it.
Maybe justice would be the right word. Like, yeah, that's true. Like, way to be psycho, Jenny. Oh man. But yeah, that was, yeah, every one of these like sections is just amazing. Gives you a lot of insight about things. So we do take a little bit of a break from interludes to go to Lucy after that. Let me see. So looks like she's has to say bye to Booker, and then that's really hard because Avery is like, "Hey, I kind of need your help right now." That's cruddy timing. I do really like that. Was that the next part? Did I skip part? I feel like I'm forgetting what section our lovely extra materials was, and I don't want to miss that. Oh, we missed that for sure. Should we talk about that right now, or do you want to talk about that at the end? Our amazing Far Cry.
I think our plan was to talk about it at the end, since it wasn't really within the...
Sorry, I'm breaking the flow
continuum.
How, my bad, guys.
Yeah. We're covering it chronologically, you see, so we have to okay. Far Cry.
You're right. We got to do that at the very end. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm jacking it up. Okay.
Yeah. This arc was really hard for Lucy.
I'm glad that she and Alyssa got to talk.
Yes.
That was really nice. Thank goodness Lucy gives somewhat of an approval to Alyssa. I think that will make things easier for her and for Booker and for everybody.
Well, Booker's just going to have to marry Alyssa now because that's not happening again.
That's like, the only one. Yeah, I mean, good luck getting like more approval, you know, for somebody else. Like, I really like Alyssa. So who knows? Maybe they'll get married. That'd be pretty sweet. And she gave Lucy some pretty good advice. Go with compassion, which, you know, it's hard to do that with everybody, like Brett. But, you know, some of like, you know, Brett's. He's a special case. Whereas other people like ghouls and like, you know, other, you know, people, you know, it's a lot easier to go at with compassion.
I think that was really good advice for where Lucy is at this part of the story, because she's looking for a way to like not back down and to not like compromise on her values. And Alyssa has, but also like she doesn't want to be violent anymore. And Alyssa's kind of provided this way of like, hey, you don't have to, you know, you can give some people not even like the benefit of the doubt, but just kind of like try to approach things from a compassionate place, and then see where that leads. And I think that like Lucy will be able to like get a lot of things done and be able to really like advance a lot of things she cares about, with this tactic instead of like, like a lot of people respond better to like compassion and like trying to be empathetic or whatever can help you figure out like what other people want and can help you like get other things that you want. And I was just like, ooh, we really need this. And it's interesting like how bad this chapter is for Lucy. I don't think it's at all a reflection of like her following Alyssa's advice, but just thinking about this first chapter and then where she ends up at the end of the fight with Chloe. It's just like, such a bad chapter for her, or such a bad arc that it makes me miss her therapist, the woman she talked to while they were at the BHI. She seemed really great.
Yeah, I want to see more of her.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I mean, I do like to touch on the whole Alyssa and the compassion thing. I really like the point that is good for where she is, because I don't want Lucy to lose her push for the fight. Like, you know, it's so important that she sort of fights to make the world better, but then also like there are some instances where it's not malicious or so, like you know, the compassion is more helpful than the fight, and it's sort of having all the tools so that you're always moving things forward. Like sometimes you know, with someone like Melissa, the fight isn't the answer, whereas, you know, with Bristow or Alexander, it probably was.
That's fair.
So yeah. So it's not like replacing her strategy, but like expanding her toolbox almost.
I think it's also fair to point out that one of the kind of overarching goals of Kennet and the practitioners, the core Kennetiers in this story, is trying to not just have violence and kind of domination be the only tool in a practitioner's tool belt.
Yeah.
So it is a good reminder for Lucy to be like, remember, we're trying to, you can't always do it, but we're trying to be kind of better as a society here.
Yeah, I think she tends to, or like you sometimes get better reactions from people or better responses. And if you're thinking like, oh, what does this person want? Or you're trying to see them as like a whole person or whatever. Sometimes you can even like have better resolutions to conflicts. And I think Lucy, you'll be really good at that once she just kind of practices and gives, like, practices having compassion for people as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think we have to worry too much about her losing the fight, especially like since right after she leaves, she goes and is like, fuck you, Brett.
yeah, true. Like, that is a great moment, though. Yeah, like, start with compassion, and then she turns into like, a fox to fuck him.
Yeah, that was so great. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that as like a great example of, yeah, like how she was, you know, it's like picking your tools, right? Brett serves as a good example of like, yeah, but sometimes you just need to fucking lay into them.
And I feel like, yeah, getting that advice is probably good. Sometimes you need like an external perspective to kind of help, I guess, shift your way of thinking just a little bit. And I think, not to say Lucy wasn't compassionate or anything beforehand, but definitely led with a lot more aggression. And I think, yeah, this is, if anything, like you're kind of saying, just adding another tool to her toolbox, making it a little bit easier to deal with different types of people moving forward. It's pretty cool that I guess like just the more that the story goes forward, it's kind of neat seeing the Kenneteers kind of gain a little bit of each other's traits, you know, as well. But I feel like probably hanging out with Avery makes it a little bit easier to for Lucy to start with the compassion. And I don't know, it just, I was getting a little bit of an Avery vibe.
It's a nice shortcut to being a more well-rounded person who's just, you know, form a soul bond with a few other people so you smooth each other out.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great idea.
Well, I think it's like a great example of one of those times where the stuff in the other verse, it's like the magic is just, like if it is sort of their soul bond helping them do personality bleed or whatever, like, that's just a bit of, that's just the magic exaggerating how it works in real life. Cause it's like the people we surround ourselves with are like the people who we're going to learn from in the same sort of way. So it's like, it could just be non-magical. It's just like the fact that she's hanging around Avery, it makes sense that like she'd see these traits that she likes and respects in Avery and tries to pick them up herself. Cause that's what people do.
That's a good point. Not everything has to be magical. Not everything has to be practitioner.
or everyone, Ruben.
Or everyone. But
I still think Verena's mum is secretly going to turn out to be a practitioner. I think that's definitely happening.
Okay, I do have a point to that, which I was going to wait until we get to closer to that.
Come on, let's get into it. Let's get into it.
I don't know. We can wait. We can, like, we're trying to do things chronologically, right?
All right.
So, waiting till the 14.12 to the end. So, I'll just hold it back, you know. But I do have a little point, you know. It's probably not going to change your idea about it whatsoever, but, you know.
Yeah, and I think we'll save that one for a while because, well, spoiler alert, this is future Elliot here. Some stuff came up, and this has now become part one of reflecting on Arc 10 because we only got about halfway through our skipped. So we'll be back with Malia and Jenny next week to do a follow-up and finish off reflecting on Arc 10. But in the meantime, you know, all the usual outro shit, there's discussion threads and Twitters and discussion questions and Patreons, Wildbo's Patreon, our Patreon, etc. We'll be back next week. We'll have our regular episode in the meantime, but for those of you Malia and Jenny fans listening, for them, they'll be back in about a week to discuss the rest of Arc 10 with us. So we'll see you then.